Money FM 89.3, best of prime time. Market View on Money FM 89.3.
You're listening to Money FM 89.3 this Monday afternoon, and we are coming closer and closer to the start of the second half of this year. Indeed, the landscape might have changed significantly, especially after the Federal Reserve adopted that more hawkish stance at their most recent policy meeting. And of course, there are still a lot of uncertainties surrounding inflation, COVID-19 infections, and also just how uneven the restarting or the reopening of economies are across this particular region. How might this actually affect markets moving forward? And is there still room for optimism in the last 6 months of the year? Today on Money FM 89.3, we're joined by Mr. Adam Matthews, the head of client portfolio managers at Eastspring Investments. And now Eastspring has also just released their second half outlook on markets, and we want to see what they're actually eyeing and focusing on through their specific markets and investor lenses. Mr. Matthews, thank you so much for joining us today. Glad to hear you and your loved ones are still safe and in good health during these very uncertain times. And welcome to the show. Happy Monday, and hope you've had a good start to the week, sir.
Great. Thanks very much for having me, JP. Appreciate it.
All right. So, Adam, you know, in Eastspring's mid-year report, when I skimmed through the first few pages, actually references quite a bit U.S. exceptionalism. Can you tell us what you mean by that U.S. exceptionalism and why it's so dependent on U.S. monetary policy also?
Sure. Okay. Well, just to be clear, it's not a term that Eastspring have coined themselves. It's a term that's been around for a long time, going back to the 19th century. Traditionally, within an economic context, U.S. exceptionalism referred to the structure of U.S. market capitalism, its free market principles, the American approach to risk-taking, innovation, etc. I think in the context that we discuss U.S. exceptionalism in our mid-year market outlook, we're really referring to the more recent confluence of factors that led the U.S. economy to recover from the COVID crisis quickly, and in a recent period quickly, because as we know, the U.S. didn't deal particularly well with the COVID crisis at the outset. But those confluence of factors which led to a more recent recovery are really that exceptionally large stimulus spending that they have unfolded over the last, say, 12 or 18 months, the rapid vaccine rollout and the acceleration of pent-up consumer demand. So I think that's really the context that we're coming to the, you know, we're still from a global context at Eastspring, we're still overweight the U.S. market. And again, it's that confluence of factors that's led to that.
So exceptional stimulus from the U.S., but of course, there's now that new, very important factor about the Federal Reserve sounding a lot more hawkish last Thursday. How has this redefined this exceptionalism that Eastspring is noticing?
It's a great question. And in fact, you know, we keep thinking, would we answer this question differently had we gone back, you know, to Wednesday or Thursday in particular? And I don't think so. I think initially the Fed was essentially just trying to replot the course of the recovery initially last week on Wednesday by signaling they could raise rates potentially twice in 2023, which frankly the market had already anticipated. And previously the Fed had been signaling rate hikes only in 2024. Now, a rate hike in 2023 would imply potentially tapering of that asset purchase program. Usually the tapering comes first, mm-hmm. and then the rate hikes come second. But I think what threw, you know, everybody into the hawkish camp was the comments that James Bullard, St. Louis Fed president, made on Friday, and he kind of even accelerated that 2023 point forward to 2022. So the question is obviously that the FOMC is comprised of 18 members, and there's a variety of views within that group. And one would have thought that the messaging, particularly this time around, would be pretty on message, and that everybody would be really giving the same clear long-term glide path for markets. And they seem to deviate that, at least Bullard did with his comments on Friday. So it'll be interesting to see whether they walk that back over the next few days. And, you know, a little like what we saw in the original taper tantrum in 2013, they kind of walked back Bernanke's comments in the weeks after that. So, again, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, I think, in the next couple of weeks. But I think in the long run, i.e. the next 2 to 3 years, we don't expect this to materially change the trajectory of the recovery. And if you even think if the Fed came out and said, well, we're raising rates, you know, next week by 25 basis points, I think the view from our side would be, you know, the trajectory of the recovery, although it's not fully embedded yet, certainly not on a global basis, but on the U.S. basis, looks pretty good. And you know, that combination of stimulus and economic reopening and as I said, the pent-up consumer demand is really playing out quite strongly. So, you know, I think that's the key now will be what happens over the next few weeks while we get clarity on what the Fed really meant by this.
All right. We're speaking to Adam Matthews, the head of client portfolio managers at Eastspring Investments here on Money FM 89.3, to get Eastspring's outlook for markets in the second half. And we're talking about all the stimulus that might start to taper off from the Fed slowly but surely. But as we know, Adam, it's also argued that stimulus, whether it's fiscal or monetary, doesn't come free. And in fact, with all this massive stimulus, we've also seen rising debt levels on the sovereign level that markets are perhaps watching with a little bit of consternation. Can you give us a few examples of where debt levels are rising and what are the market implications should these debt levels remain elevated or not even brought back or not even perhaps just normalized in some form or fashion?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. And it's, I think, the one that we're going to be asking ourselves more and more in the next couple of years as we emerge from into the really post-COVID, you know, normalization of the economy. Then we look back and see, you know, all of the long-term damage that was done by COVID. And one of the ones clearly that will be on the agenda is the high levels of global debt. So I think the numbers stack up to around $24 trillion U.S. dollars of global debt was added in 2020. And that across the board, most of that was at the government and to some lesser extent, perhaps corporate level. And so that takes global debt to GDP ratios pretty high to, you know, around 350%, up from about 315% in 2019. So, you know, massive, you know, stimulus has a big cost. And you know, I think it's interesting. Some market observers are now saying, well, it's not the overall level of debt that matters, but how much, you know, government expenditure goes to servicing that debt. And while that's true probably in the near term, coming back to the first point, is that over the longer term, as rates do rise, then, of course, those debt servicing levels will rise as well. And I think if we just cast our mind back to the post-GFC period in Europe, global financial crisis period, where many countries were hampered for several years by austerity measures afterwards in order to pay down the very steep increases in debt levels we saw in GFC. So that's potentially an overhang that the world will have to deal with. And individually, there are certain countries like, you know, even Greece or Italy, increasingly France and the UK, debt levels have risen, US, of course. And in emerging markets, it would be Brazil, Turkey, and also China. So those are all places we have to keep an eye on. But again, you know, it could take several years for that to play out as rates gradually rise as opposed to rise very dramatically, we imagine.
All right. So we've laid out U.S. exceptionalism as being part of Eastspring's mid-year outlook for markets. Can you help us round out the overall outlook for markets in the second half for Eastspring, especially for markets, say, here in Asia and even here in Singapore? Help us understand, get a more full picture now of what Eastspring is expecting in the last 6 months of the year.
Okay. I think you know, it obviously Asia's had its third wave, and while having dealt with the COVID crisis initially very well in terms of keeping COVID at bay, and in particular in places like Singapore with very quick reaction time and measures imposed by the government, now what we really need is the rollout of vaccines. And that seems to be the answer for markets to fully reopen, as we've seen in parts of Europe and the U.S., is to get as much of the population vaccinated as possible so the economy can return to normal. So I think that kind of the delay of that perhaps in parts of Asia, and especially in emerging Asia, we've seen these, you know, variants, the Delta variant, you know, wreak havoc in India and parts of Southeast Asia. So I think we'll see a delayed reaction. It should happen that those countries also recover over the next, 6 to 9 months. And as again, more and more of those populations become vaccinated. You know, Singapore has traditionally been a value-biased market with high weightings in financials and real estate stocks. So again, you know, that's actually quite a good place to be right now as investors rotate into more cyclical value names we've seen over the last 6 months. And so again, we'd expect that to pace to carry out over the next 6 months as the broad recovery starts to open. So perhaps a little bit of a delayed reaction here in Singapore, but we now see the pace of reopening in other markets, so it should come here too.
Right. And finally, Adam, you know, when we talk about the Fed's hawkish stance, and we seem to come back to this this theme because it's been such a prominent theme over the last couple of days, we also have to take note of the dollars. Rather bullish a pickup also. The greenback has actually strengthened, much to the detriment actually of commodities and even emerging market currencies. So then this brings up the question of how this hawkish stance of the Fed might actually impact some of these emerging markets here in Asia, particularly the ones that are most vulnerable to possible outflows. How big of a game changer is this actually for, say, Eastspring's outlook for emerging markets here?
So I think we still have a view that, a long-term view that we'll see a weakening dollar. Now, as I said, we might get these brief snapbacks. The dollar was perhaps oversold over the last few months, and we'll see whether this is a real hawkish change by the Fed or not, frankly, I think over the next few months, a few weeks. But you know, the dollar snapback, we suspect, is probably more a short-term function, and actually, there's two forces that are basically battling each other out right now here. One is if the rates were to rise faster than the U.S. and elsewhere, that sucks money back into the U.S. economy and into U.S. fixed income securities in particular. But actually, as the economy recovery unfolds there, we expect, and in particular consumption, we probably see the traditional forces of against the dollar, which are, you know, trade deficits, et cetera, continue to be the kind of overhang there. So I think the key is, you know, long-term dollar depreciation or dollar weakness is still probably the name of the game. If we look forward 12 or 18 months, we may see brief periods, but that's probably not a long enough period to really destabilize those countries' higher dollar-based borrowings. So I think they should probably be able to manage through this.
All right. Adam Matthews, head of...